Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Alexander Lees. He's a senior lecturer in biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University and associate of Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And we're talking about his new book, written with James Gilroy, Vagrancy in Birds. Alex, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Okay, well, fantastic. Pleasure to talk about it, Mark.
Well, let's start out by defining vagrancy for people who don't know what it is.
Actually, quite a hard definition, but I guess we think about vagrancy as being occurrences of an organism, and, you know, the book is about birds, but it could be any organism, outside of its normal geographic range limit. So if you think about, if you have a bird book in front of you, you have a distribution map, and part of that map is filled by a shape, which is the bird's range, and quite often, well, vagrants are species which occur outside of that range. But the reason being quite difficult to define, because obviously ranges don't often just stop immediately, and, you know, birds get rarer and rarer towards the range edges, so it can be quite tricky to know sort of when something is a vagrant and when isn't.
You talked about vagrancy in other species other than birds, but other than vertebrates, birds, in, are there other vertebrates that are vagrants as often as birds are? Birds, because they can fly, seem to be the perfect species for vagrancy.
Yeah, well, so another, within insects, so moths.
Yeah, but for vertebrates, yeah.
So pinnipeds, and allies, and cetaceans quite frequently occur as vagrants. You know, they can swim, you know, very large distances. We think of vertebrates, mammals, essentially, as being, you know, far less likely to be vagrants. But there was a really cool record, for instance, of a mountain lion, which was, I think it was radio-collared in somewhere in the Midwest, which ended up in Connecticut a few years ago, for instance. So,
But in that case, it's interesting. We were within the historical range of mountain lions.
Well, it absolutely used to occur in the eastern U.S. In
fact, that's right.
Species, which was declared extinct, though. So this individual from the West is still nominally a vagrant, but essentially it was retaking, you know, ground historically
wow.
by the species.
This book is amazing because it takes a global look at avian vagrancy. And please, I want you to talk about a minute about putting this book together, because it seems incredibly challenging.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. And
yeah.
A lot of reading, a lot of literature, and a lot of going through Birds of the World, and a lot of reading regional books to try and pick out some of these records. But the idea is sort of trying to look at a global level, because there's been several other books sort of trying to look at a more local level, you know, quite a few sort of dealing with records of vagrants in the United Kingdom in the US, so sort of howler owls, rare birds in North America, for instance. But the phenomenon, you know, hasn't really been considered at a global level. And, you know, there's a vast part of the sort of avian tree of life which there's sort of no information from. And because of this sort of biases, you know, with lots of data from Western Europe and lots of data from North America, a lot of our sort of efforts to sort of make sense of the phenomenon have taken place in those regions. And we sort of argue in many cases that maybe this has perhaps led us up some sort of wrong tracks as well, with trying to understand the sort of patterns and maybe even the processes.
Birders live for vagrants. I mean, that's the big thing that birders are always looking for, is they hope to stumble across some vagrant. And for people who aren't birders who are listening, you probably have read a newspaper article lately about the Stellar Sea Eagle. And that was a case of extreme vagrancy. That bird wasn't even supposed to move anywhere near the United States, and ended up in Texas, then up in Massachusetts, and then mostly up in Maine. Pink-footed goose, I just saw one this weekend. That's a Eurasian species, not supposed to be here. That's a vagrant. To understand vagrancy, and you make this very clear in the beginning of the book, we have to understand how birds navigate and where things go wrong, is if it's a breakdown in their navigation. And we're not going to talk about all the details in it, but what is the avian compass that you talk about?
The avian compass is this notion that birds, in order to navigate, migratory species, that, you know, they have, well, four different potential sort of compass bearings of which they can, decide essentially which direction north is and orientate with respect to north to reach their destination. So, you know, some of these examples of avian compasses, for instance, include the star compass. So
yeah.
Many birds will memorize the patterns in the starscape and look at the night sky and then use that as a cue to work out where they're going. But they also have like access to like a magnetic compass as well. So ability to sort of, again, orientate with respect to north based on their ability to detect sort of variations in the Earth's magnetic field, right? So, and I'm trying to think of all the remaining compasses we've got potentially for taxa to migrate off the top of my head.
But for a bird to become a vagrant through compass error, what would that involve?
So that involves essentially the bird misreading its internal compass bearing. So the four compass bearings, then remembering now, we've got the sun, polarized light, the stars, and the magnetic field. So, you know, you've got four sort of fallback insurance policies to make this correct orientation decision. And so when the bird, when it starts its, you know, migration, has to identify which direction north is, and then angle itself with respect to north and then head in that direction. So vagrancy with respect to sort of to compass failings, one potential mechanism is sort of widely called reverse migration literature. So in this case, a bird is essentially failing to read which direction north is and erroneously, you know, confusing north with south and therefore moving in the opposite direction to which it might normally. A second potential failing is mirror image misorientation, where they sort of get the first step right, so they're going to head south in the autumn, or if they're a southern hemisphere species, they're heading sort of north in the autumn, but have got the sort of the left and the right mixed up. Essentially, they're getting east or west mixed up, and therefore head southeast rather than southwest, for instance. And then there's some evidence, actually, when you look at all the data for these species, that there is, you know, some supporting evidence for patterns of in certain directions seeming to accrue more records, but equally, you know, it seems that birds can turn up, you know, almost anywhere. So in the book, we use this example of scissortail flycatcher as an example, simply
yep.
because it's a species with quite a restricted breeding and discrete wintering range, and it's a very easy to identify species. So lots and lots of data from that, you know, that it often get missed. And we see this sort of wide scatter of records for that species.
Well, here in Massachusetts, we've even had several records of fork-tailed flycatcher from South America. And is that an example of reverse migration?
Quite possibly, yeah. And it's an intriguing instance of reverse migration, if that's the case, because if that's the case, these fork-tailed flycatchers are from this austral breeding population of the species. So there are various different subspecies. So these birds would have essentially been bred somewhere in the southern cone of South America, in Brazil or Argentina, and then migrated north to their wintering grounds, most of the winter, like on the Llanos in Venezuela, and then moving, you know, instead of moving south back down to southern Brazil and Argentina, some of those birds end up going north and ending up in North America, you know, basically in their spring.
Yep, right,
when they
exactly
should be heading back to breed, they end up heading north in their spring and end up in North America's late autumn. So that suggests the birds have completed their first migration without a hitch, but they've crossed the equator and suddenly haven't, for some reason, they haven't sort of recognized the fact they crossed the equator.
That's wild.
So they've, you know, they're not adjusting for the fact that they're, you know, part of their compass, the north-south sort of polarization, if you like, and they're not sort of noticing this sort of magnetic field difference. Well, that's one hypothesis for that. It may be that the birds are moved downwind in storm systems, for instance, or there are various possible reasons, but that it seems to make sense. And there are corresponding patterns of migration in some species which migrate sort of in the Palearctic and Afrotropical system. Things like citrine wagtail is one we mentioned as well,
which
is a bird which, you know, sort of breeds in Eastern Europe and then migrates to sort of Central Africa. And then there's a peak of records in Southern Africa. At the same time, the birds ought to be moving north. So again, suggests this sort of a failure to recognize that they've crossed the equator and the polarity of their system has changed.
One of the things you address in the book, and I find this really interesting, talking about the pink-footed goose, it was with Canada geese. And vagrancy in social migrants, what may happen is this vagrant may just join up with similar species and follow their pattern for a while.
Yeah, so in many species, migration is not sort of a genetically pre-programmed, and sort of migration, you know, happens through social learning. So, you know, birds learn their migration routes by sort of following their parents, for instance, to the wintering area. So we know this happens in geese and in cranes and in swans and various other, usually quite large-bodied bird species. So if a juvenile of these species becomes detached from its sort of parent flock, or indeed any sort of conspecific, any member of their own species, they may end up tagging along with a member of a different species, which is sent on a different flyway, and can then eventually take them, you know, half a hemisphere sort of out of range, for instance.
Let's talk about the sky, too, and wind drift and problems like that. One of the things you talk about, the sky is a complex habitat, and the birds are in the middle of it. And things like the jet streams and so on and so forth can actually contribute to their being a vagrant.
Indeed, yeah. So I think we have this sort of bias as being this sort of, you know, diurnal terrestrial primate, right? And our notion of the sky is this thing above us, you know, it's usually blue, unless it's here in England where it's usually grey and it's raining. But we don't really have, you know, a good understanding of what the sky's like, really. I mean, we fly up into it in an aeroplane occasionally, and then we're sort of hermetically sealed from that environment. But the sky is very complex. You know, there are different boundary layers, and the wind can be moving in different directions, you know, from, you know, almost the opposite direction, in fact, from high up, from low down. And birds basically have to navigate this habitat, you know, when they're migrating, and they move, they move routinely up and down the sort of the column in height, basically, to try and take advantage of whenever the wind is favorable for them. So there's a huge sort of capacity to make errors, especially for sort of naive migrants, can easily get stuck in a layer of wind which is very, very unfavorable. And, you know, if you're a bird on migration, it's very difficult to fight against the wind, and especially if you end up over water, at that point you just got to go with the wind. You know, if you're fortunate to be caught out over land, you can drop down and wait. But if you're, especially if you're a migrant which has sort of substantial over water migrations, then you literally have to just go with the flow at that point. So lots of sort of research in the last sort of decade or so has really transformed our knowledge about the sort of the, what we call aeroecology, the sort of study of the air as a sort of a biological habitat and how the organisms react to it. And yes, you mentioned jet streams. So, you know, these columns of air, these air masses, can be moving incredibly fast. And there's now increasing evidence that some birds can move at such a height, you know, several kilometers, that they can become entrained in low-level jets. So, you know, quite possible that some species take advantage of these, you know, very extreme conditions. But, you know, if you're able to ride these jets, then, you know, you can make it to your winter quarters in very, 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 very quickly indeed.
And there's also extreme weather. And here in the northeast of the United States, and perversely, birders love hurricanes because hurricanes bring up, literally from the Caribbean, vagrant species that show up in like inland reservoirs here in Massachusetts. You know, we've had sooty terns, you know, we've even had tropic birds that have all been hurricane assisted. And I'm always amazed that the birds are able to stay in the storm and make it all the way up the coast.
Yeah, so we know very well, very little about exactly the behavior of these birds in hurricanes. We only know that, you know, they show up, you know, the next morning in, you know, marginally less inclement conditions and to be detected inland. So presumably a lot of these birds must, you know, be riding perhaps the eye or the regions of lower wind speed and then end up following that system in those more clement conditions. But, you know, I'm not aware of anyone having tracked a bird in storm to know about exactly their behavior. I mean, I'm sure it'll happen one of these days. There's so many sort of data loggers, satellite tags, you know, on seabirds. I'm sure we'll, at some point, there'll be a nice paper showing exactly what happens with that. But we know the end result is lots of birds being displaced, presumably lots of birds dying, and presumably
That's right.
some birds being able to reorientate when you when you look at, you see records of vagrant pterodroma petrels. They never seem to be there very long at these inland reservoirs. So at least some of them presumably can make it back, you know, out back into the Gulf Stream, which is where they wanted to be in the first place.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Mark Lynch. My name, my guest tonight is Alexander Lees. He's a senior lecturer in biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University, an associate of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And we're talking about his new book, written with James Gilroy, Vagrancy in Birds. Now, it's an interesting thing that's happened here in the Northeast with rufous hummingbirds. Now, I've been birding since the mid-1970s, and we never used to see them here. They just never showed up. And within the last 20 years, every late fall, there's a report of one of these Western hummingbirds. It's most often a rufous, but it can be any one of a number of other species. Is this a case of the bird just naturally dispersing?
Possibly. So we've got various, well, I guess what we determine is natural at this point, right? And what degree that how people have shaped what we call as natural. So, for instance, it's possible that, you know, we formerly weren't detecting these birds because they weren't there. It's also possible.
Well, you know, they most often show up at people's hummingbird feeders, which have increased exponentially, and people are keeping their hummingbird feeders up longer. And these birds usually show up after the ruby throats are gone.
Yeah. So part of that, again, could be behavioral, as in behavioral for birders. So birders are provided a resource, which these hummingbirds can essentially use as stepping stones moving eastwards. And it's possible that these migrations or these vagrancy events happened historically, but because there's no resources, birds would never make it to the East Coast. And that provisioning of late season resources has allowed that. It's possible that increases in bird is obviously increased detectability. Possibly, you know, that all of these impacts and or changes in land use or anything else have resulted in larger populations of rufous hummingbirds as well and more vagrants. So there's always one of the problems with trying to understand vagrancy is all these sort of competing factors. You're often struggling to know if it's a genuine change in behavior or a change in the way that behavior is measured. But I'd agree with you that, you know, there's the evidence that providing late season resources is probably really critical for certainly the initial occurrence of these hummingbirds early in the season and certainly their survivorship out there. And we have an image in the book of a Salaparous hummingbird, which is, you know, in the snow and conditions.
I've actually seen stuff like that. Well, you know, there's an interesting singular story of a rufous hummingbird. It showed up at a feeder in November in Agawam, which is in the Connecticut River Valley. And it was netted and banded. And then a friend of mine offered to take it in for the winter in his greenhouse. So he did. And come April, he just opened the door and let the hummingbird out. He called it Rufy. It was a rufous hummingbird. That bird came back to the same feeder and was netted and kept in the same greenhouse for 5 years in a row. So that seemed to indicate that somehow, I think, keeping it over winter was changing its habits. It was very weird. It's the only case I know of a repeated, documented extralimital hummingbird that kept coming back to the feeder.
So that suggests, for one thing, that probably survivorship in vagrant hummingbirds is very low, but, you know, the actions of this one person then have permitted this hummingbird to survive. And as it's one, you know, it's found a place that it can successfully winter, and it's returned. What would be really interesting to know where that bird had spent the corresponding summer.
I know. By the time the second year had happened, I kept looking for it during the summer.
There's no reason to think it wouldn't have just gone back to somewhere in the Rockies or whatever.
I know.
That, I'm sure that's what would have happened. And it's saying, well, I can successfully overwinter in a greenhouse somewhere on the East Coast, so I'll do that. That's the only experience that it knows, obviously. So, but without that intervention, obviously that bird would have died. And obviously what was interesting, I mean, if that bird is paired up and then, you know, it's then bred and it's produced chicks, and they will have inherited a migratory orientation.
I know.
Which, you know, might be taking it, you know, well, if it's a sort of an average of the two from its parent site, it might be going out to Florida or something else, you know, somewhere else it shouldn't be, potentially.
Now, there's also examples of human-assisted vagrancy, and that's most often ship-assisted. We have a good example here. All of a sudden, a jackdaw showed up in Nantucket, and everybody, of course, all the birders went out to see the jackdaw. And then they come to find out a ship that came across the Atlantic Ocean had a group of jackdaws on it that got off the ship as they approached mainland here in North America. That seems to happen more often than you would think, that birds are assisted in their vagrancy with ships.
I think it's very, very common. And so I sit on the British Ornithological Union Records Committee. So after someone that part of the committee that judges whether or not a species admitted to the British list as a first record.
I was just reading British Birds about the Patterfield, pipit, I think.
Patterfield pipit, yeah. So
and that was not accepted.
No, that was it ended up on category D, so it's like a holding category. Basically, with that bird, it's one of the craziest examples of potential vagrancy, because it's almost like a sedentary tropical passerine species, and we know from the DNA evidence of that bird that it could certainly come from Western India, and it wouldn't be an expected bird to occur as a vagrant in Western Europe. You know, we get lots of Asian vagrants, but they're all tend to be migratory species which breed in Siberia and then winter in Southeast Asia. So that was a very odd bird. But with that bird, you know, vagrancy was unlikely, but everything else was unlikely. There wasn't much evidence of the bird in trade. You'd think, you know, would that bird survive for 20 days on a ship or whatever? So nothing seemed likely about that bird. So personally, I think ship is a possibility, but plane is even a possibility.
That's
there's several
right.
records of birds sort of stowing away in the undercarriage of aircraft and being moved thousands of thousands of kilometres. And you look at various Facebook groups over here and see the amount of things that you can buy these days. It's incredible. So these decisions of trying to work out whether or not something is, you know, a genuine vagrant versus a ship-assisted vagrant versus an escape is always difficult. And it's difficult even to think about, well, you think about ship assistance. I mean, is that a natural phenomenon? It's like, well, our ships aren't nominally natural, but, I mean, we are natural. And that bird is just taking advantage of human infrastructure.
It's That's
like
right.
saying, how do we dial out the effects of climate change on changing bird ranges, and which obviously can lead to vagrancy as well. And so there's a lot of things that we do to the environment. The hummingbird example is a good one as well, right? I mean, without that provisioning of resources, something else I also work on, you know, we wouldn't have those sort of East Coast records of hummingbirds. So it is very difficult, and sort of short of sticking an individual bird of a given species in a wind tunnel and seeing, you know, how far it could go, we don't know. But this is the problem we have in the UK, for instance, when we're trying to work out whether a towhee could have got here unassisted.
That's right.
And we have an eastern towhee record. Actually, we have a spotted towhee record, which is rejected. But actually, spotted towhee is probably more migratory than eastern towhee.
So, well, they show up on the East Coast.
I know they do, yeah, yeah. So there's a
yeah, but then that brings up the problem of the Stellar Sea Eagle, which seems to have nothing to do with North America, and this one bird showed up. And I kept wondering if it wasn't like an escape from some, you know, Russian mogul's like private collection or something like that. But I mean, that bird wandered all over the lower 48 states.
Yeah. So I was interviewed on that article you mentioned earlier for the New York Times, but that's sort of super, possibly the most celebrated vagrants, although perhaps we had a walrus in the UK for quite a long time last year, which was probably generated almost as much as many column inches. But anyway, back to Stellar Sea Eagle. So if that bird hadn't been seen in Alaska and hadn't been tracked to Alaska, I think, you know, people would be viewing it quite differently. But given that, you know, Stellar Sea Eagle is far more routine of a vagrant to Alaska, then, you know, that initial record doesn't seem that unusual. What's obviously unusual is the fact the bird has then been wandering all across the North American continent.
Including down into Texas, yeah.
Including down to Texas. But then it shouldn't perhaps come as a surprise, right? So you've got, the Stellar Sea Eagles are migratory. They do move north and south. There's a precedent for a bird, instead of moving south, moving east. So then it's in North America. So what's it going to do? You know, come spring, it wants to find another Stellar Sea Eagle, you know, and meet up and start a family, except, you know, it's wandering around and it's not finding Stellar Sea Eagles. So it's going to continue wandering around probably for the rest of its life, unless it can manage to backtrack its way to Chukotka. So, you know, and this we've also seen this in other North American raptors, you know, or raptor vagrants, you know, the great black hawk.
That's right.
From a few years ago. So these birds, even birds which are not very migratory, they will just wander. And we wonder, well, in the book, we sort of speculate that this may be the cause of records by species both in sort of birds from the desert southwest, for instance, and birds from the Sahara in Europe, desert birds, which, you know, perhaps an individual right at the edge of its range, you know, a juvenile is born, it wanders off into some non-habitat out of the desert, and then just keeps wandering, you know, it's just trying to find suitable habitat. And maybe that might explain some of these crazy records, because once a bird's lost, it's going to have this drive to try and re-find its habitat and then hopefully re-find it, you know, another member of its species. But with the sea eagle, it's sort of mostly now wandering around at almost the correct latitude, if you like, but it's got the longitude all wrong. And obviously it can find food and everything else, it just can't find a mate. And we can expect that it continue wandering potentially for the end of its life, almost like we get records of albatrosses doing this similar thing. And
that's right.
What's also interesting is that these birds, I mean, how long might they live? Because breeding obviously puts a lot of stress on a bird. You know, if these things never breed, then, you know, it could live 10 years longer than the average stellar.
Wasn't there an albatross in Britain up in the Shetlands or the Orkneys or something that just kept showing up in the nesting colony every year for like a long time? I mean, it was just expected.
There's been blackbird albatrosses, or one or more, and I say there's certainly more than one, occasional years when there's been two sort of seen in a season, never at the same colony. You know, in the UK since the 1960s, and we're reasonably sure that at least one of those birds has been around for about 15 years.
Wow!
One we had last year was visiting a gannet tree. I saw it. It's actually the bird on the cover of the book, which is photographed in Helgoland in Germany, but it's been the last 2 years. It's been in England, just not that far up the road from here, at a site called Bempton Cliffs, and sort of returning to this gannet tree. But the cool thing about that bird is that prior to being visiting this gannet tree in England, it was previously hanging out basically in sort of Germany and Denmark. And this bird was spending most of the time at a lake and hanging around with mute swans. It's sort of identified as a mute swan for a while. And it has previously been hanging out with gannets, but the gannets were really vicious to it, whereas the mute swans are a bit more passive. But then that wasn't the only thing it tried its luck with. It ended up at one point in an aviary, in a bird collection. I think it was in Germany. I can't remember if it was Germany and Denmark. It's right on the border, basically, where this thing hangs out. It was dropped in next to a red-crowned crane in an aviary and had to be rescued. And then it tried to make friends with some white-tailed eagles. And that happened at least twice. And there's photos of this thing being chased by white-tailed eagles.
Oh,
and
God.
Then I think it was in June last year or the year before, it was reported as being killed by white-tailed eagles. You know, it was seen being chased by like 10 of them. And then wasn't seen again. But then it reappeared in England after that. It gave up on continental Europe because the white-tailed eagles weren't very welcoming for it. So, you know, this bird is just desperate to find a mate, basically, and it's trying on with anything that's, you know, large and black and white. And maybe one of these days, you know, it'll find another.
It'll find another vagrant. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is Alexander Lees, Senior Lecturer in Biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University and Associate of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We've been talking about his new book, which is amazing. We didn't even get to the family accounts, which are wild. His book is with James Gilroy, Vagrancy in Birds. I strongly recommend it. I think it's one of my favorite bird books of the year already. And Alexander, the account of some of the species in this book, like the sheathbill and I think the ptarmigan, blow my mind that
Absolutely,
there's actually
yeah.
vagrancy records of them. Thank you so much for your time, Alex.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Mark Lynch, and this is WICN and Inquiry.